Please join me in welcoming our main speaker, Treehouse Dave, from Law... How do you say the place?
La Crescenta.
La Crescenta.
Good evening, everybody. My name is David Delvis, and I'm an alcoholic. And first off, it's good to be sober, good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Lee for asking me to come out here and share with you guys tonight. I'm one of those people that believes it's an honor and privilege to be able to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And happy birthday to all the birthday people. And I'd like to thank Jackie for doing an incredible job for her 10 minutes. I was sitting there for a moment, and one of the things that I said to her before the meeting started, and this is, I don't know if anybody remembers Don Gates. He was a speaker from way back in the day. And one of the things that he used to say before he spoke is to kind of lighten the mood a little bit. He goes, "All I'm going to do is carry a simple message of hope that you guys can build your lives upon." And I said that to Jackie, and she went, "Oh my God, don't give me that kind of pressure." You know? And I said, "No, no, no." But I was sitting there, and I'm listening to her share for 10 minutes. And as you guys were reading the traditions, and you read that the fifth tradition says each group has but one primary purpose: to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And I think you did an amazing job of that. I personally do, upholding the tradition of the meeting that we're supposed to be doing here, and I'm hoping I can do half as well. You know, just to be honest, it's just like, you know, this is what it's all about around here. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll give you my sobriety birth date. My sobriety birth date is December 19th of 1988. I always like to say that I haven't been drunk or loaded this millennium. You know, it's been a while. It's been a while. I am coming up on 36 years of sobriety. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is a guy by the name of Bill C. He's not my first sponsor, but he's a sponsor I have at the moment. My last sponsor that I had before him for 14 and a half years was a guy by the name of Bob Fisher. I don't know if anybody here knew Bob Fisher from down in the San Fernando Valley. He ran the San Fernando Valley Central Office for 20 years. And he passed away in February the year before, and didn't ask my permission before he died, you know, and I kind of, because we weren't done yet, in my opinion, you know, that kind of a thing. But whenever you make that connection with a really good sponsor, you know what I'm talking about. And I had that connection with him. And so I miss him still. I miss him still. But it's just like I do. And one of the things is, like, I love the tradition of the steps being done around the room. And believe it or not, I'm part of a Sunday night speaker meeting. And years ago, we went to a meeting one time. We used to have a traveling a Wednesday night roving stag. And we used to go to different meetings. And the rule was, we'd pick a secretary the week before. And it was the secretary's job was simply to pick the meeting for the following week. That was your job. As the secretary of this roving stag, we'd meet out in front of the clubhouse, and off we would go. And the only rule was it had to be within 45 minutes of our starting point. And we went to this one particular meeting, and they did the steps. And we thought, oh, we're going to bring that back to our Sunday night speaker meeting. We started doing made-up cards. But one of the things is I was telling, is it Felina? Did I get that right? Perfect. I got that. I was telling Felina, she actually had step 12. And I looked over at her, and I went, well, at our meeting, what we do is we give step 12 to the speaker, since they're carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't say it that uppity, but that's the way it kind of it feels like sometimes. And so she sits there and she goes, well, and she slides it over. You're like, no. But the thing is, we learn to take direction, you know? And so I went ahead and I did that. And just to let you know, I think it's kind of a cool tradition. You guys can use it or not. It's up to you, you know, anyway. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. So you got my sobriety date. You know I have a sponsor. And if you're new here, can I see the hands of anybody with like less than a year of sobriety in the room tonight? Can I see the hands of all the people with less than a year of sobriety? That's not me. I'm just using myself as an example, just to point that out. But welcome to you guys. And I always like to say that I'm speaking for you guys. And I have a sponsor. And if you're new, if you don't have a sponsor, as Jackie talked about quite a bit, you know, the thing is a sponsor is this. A sponsor is somebody who's willing to give you their time. As an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous used to say, for fun and for free, that we do this, as a result of just giving of our time, because one of the most valued commodities that we have, especially when we come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, is our time that we're willing to give people. And as a result of them giving up their time and sharing with you their experience, strength, and hope, their experience with the steps, how they went through this, the things they did in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't know about you, but I had this vision of what I thought a sponsor was in Alcoholics Anonymous when I first came through the doors, and I'll get into my story in just a minute. But the thing was, is that I thought that the people that had been sober for quite a while in Alcoholics Anonymous were like, well, I don't know where I got that idea, but I kind of thought that. You know, I thought that they were spiritually uplifted, that they were above me somehow, that they had some sort of great insight into all this kind of stuff. If you're new, that is totally not true. I'll tell you that right now. If you've been around here any length of time, you know the truth is, it's just like, we are all just broken, busted people who just don't seem to be able to function well in society. And we come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not the well parts that mesh and click with us. It's those broken pieces of us. And that's what really works, because up until Alcoholics Anonymous was born, the solution for our disease was this. And I don't know if any of you have ever read the good book at all. You know, I'm talking about the Bible. But anyway, one of the lines in the Bible is, they say, this was their solution. They say, he is a profligate and a drunkard, and we shall take him out to the edge of town and stone him to death. That was the spiritual approach to alcoholism until 1935, basically. You know, for 2,000 odd years, you know, whatever it was. And now we come along and all of a sudden we're able to do this thing, and we're able to get and stay sober simply with this connection that we make when we share our stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. And believe it or not, it's a very oral thing that happens in AA. You know, we're at a speaker meeting, but you go to participation meetings, book studies, step studies, and it's always about just kind of looking at the stuff and kind of breaking it down and sharing your stories with other people. And something happens. A magic in Alcoholics Anonymous happens when we do this. And all of a sudden, where people like me could not stay sober any length of period of time at all. I'm one of those people like to talk about who would swear off and says they'd be boiled as an owl by lunchtime or whatever it says in the book. I was one of those people. I couldn't see, even on the best, most honest, sincere desire to stay sober for the rest of my life when I got it, because I was tired of paying the price. Now, I don't know if there's anybody in here when we came in here and we were just so sick and tired of paying the price, you know? And we try to use that to stay sober. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, it's not enough. It's not enough. And the book even says, you know what? If you can just stop drinking or using, no matter what, our hats are off to you. If you can do whatever you can, any other process, we don't corner the market on sobriety. We simply seem to have a process that works for us. It's been working for quite a while, you know, and I love what happens around here. And I came into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 24 years old, going to 25, and I was dying of this disease. I don't know, those people that all raised your hand, I don't know what your last year was like before it got up to the point where you're standing now and you're going from day zero to wherever you're at in that first 365 days. I don't know exactly what brought you to that day zero. But if it was anything like my last year out there, it sucked. That's all I can tell you. It was hard. And when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think this was going to work. I thought I was wasting my time. I didn't know why I was here. I didn't feel like anybody could connect to me. I didn't think they could. They introduced me. My nickname in Alcoholics Anonymous is Treehouse David. That's my nickname in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you know anything about the nicknames, it has some reflection on your personality, either positive or negative. There's a guy I know called Non-Controversial Steve, and they call him Non-Controversial Steve because he argues with everybody, you know? There was another guy they called Never Late Jim, 10 minutes late to every meeting he went to, you know? There was Pumpkin Jim because he used to do Caltrans, and they used to fill the trash bags with orange, you know, the orange trash bags on the side of the road. And they call me Treehouse David, and you know, it has something to do with your personality, positive, negative. Treehouse David is my nickname. And the reason they call me Treehouse David is because I spent a brief period of life that I was out there drinking and getting loaded, living in a treehouse that I built in my parents' front yard. And that brief period of time was 10 years. Now that kind of thing, I don't play well with others, you know? And that's just what it was. And I grew up in this town, La Crescenta. It's an upper middle class. I call it a high-end blue-collar, low-end white-collar neighborhood. That's why I classify La Crescenta, you know. It's right in between La Cañada, where the rich people are, and Tujunga, where cars are sitting in the yard all year long. You know, that kind of a difference, you know, that kind of a dichotomy. And there's La Crescenta. And when I grew up and I was going up to school in that area, it's a nice neighborhood. It's a decent neighborhood, I'll tell you that right now. But my parents didn't, my dad is a very frugal man. And my dad he grew up in the Depression era, that kind of a thing. And what happened was is that, you know, he didn't believe in buying new clothes. The beginning of every school year, I don't know if you ever had this happen, but like every school year, beginning of September, after that glorious 93 days of summer that we used to have, they took that away from kids. I thought that was so cruel. That's just my opinion on that one. But after that 93 days of summer, you go back to school and everybody got like brand new school clothes when I was a kid, but I didn't. My parents bought all my clothes from thrift stores, which was, it's kind of cool now, wasn't even a little bit cool when I was a kid, you know? And everybody would get like brand new school clothes, 501 button, 5 jeans, Nike and Puma tennis shoes, and white pressed t-shirts. And they would say things like, you'll grow into it eventually. I don't know if you ever had eventually clothes, but that's what I had. I didn't want eventually clothes. I wanted new clothes. And everybody else was wearing like brand new, these expensive, like they were like $30 a pair for tennis shoes, which are cheap now, but back in those days, a lot of money for a pair of Pumas. And they would get me Keds. I don't know if anybody remembers Keds or not. You know, I used to get Keds and that kind of stuff. Or the worst even, they would buy me secondhand boots. And I'll tell you this right now, if you're on the schoolyard and you're wearing secondhand boots and everybody else is wearing tennis shoes, you're a goober. There's no other word to describe it, you know? There was an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous by the name of Bobby Suazo. And I don't know if you have any of those ghosts of AA. I'm sure you do. You've been around here for a long time. But they're the ones. And he was the one that they used to go to meetings. And Bobby would do what they call, I call it batting cleanup. And what I mean was, is I'd go to a participation meeting or a step study or whatever, and Bobby would be there, and they would save Bobby for last, you know, cleanup. And what happened was, is that I'd be sitting in the meeting, and one of the things they used to say when I was new is they say, if you drank and got loaded every day, go to a meeting every day. And I, you know what, I'd just go just because I would do it, but I would go there to get like the notch on my belt, just to say I went that day. And all I wanted was to sit there and say, you know, keep coming back, it works. And I just wanted to get out of there, you know. And I'd just be sitting there and I wouldn't be hearing anything. People would be sharing and saying stuff and I wouldn't be hearing anything. I'd just be wanting the meeting to be over because I was miserable. I was unhappy. No pink cloud for me. I'll tell you, I was right with you on that one. And the thing was is that I would sit there and I would think, you know, I just want it to be done so I can say I got my meeting in for the day. And what happened was is they'd say Bobby for last, and Bobby would get up there and he would sit there, and all of a sudden he had this incredible, this amazing, this uncanny ability to be able to quote different things people would share during the meetings. But the way he would say it had a way of getting through those defenses that I had. And he would share that. And the thing is, like, if you come at me and try to share with me those kind of stuff, I would have pushed you back. Not because I wanted to keep you out, it was because I didn't know how to let you in. I was incapable of letting you in. And one of the things that he used to say that used to just hit me right through my armor was he'd say, when I was new, I felt like a turd with eyeballs. Now that guy got my attention. That's exactly the way I felt when I was new. I didn't fit in, I didn't belong, and I wasn't a part of, and I just thought I was wasting my time here. Now one of the things is, I'll tell you really quick here, is that I'm hoping for three things as I stand up here and share with you my story for the next 35 minutes or so. And my hope is this, my hope is that maybe I might tell you some of my story and you might say to yourself, I did that. Or better yet, I might talk about the way I felt, the things I did and the stuff I did and why I did, and you might say to yourself, I felt that way. But the brass ring, the one I'm really shooting for, right down the line, the one I'm really going for is, as a result of the stuff I say, the things I talk about, my reference to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps and God and all these kind of things, that maybe, and I'll do my best to get in there, that I might say some stuff, and at the end of this or somewhere during my talk, you might say to yourself, maybe this thing will work for me too. Because isn't that what it's all about? That we are able to carry this message of hope and recovery across that translunar gulf that we put in ourselves. You know, it's like it says somewhere that the only thing that keeps me between me and you and me and God is me. And that's the key. And I start doing these things around here and that kind of changes that kind of stuff. And, you know, I just didn't fit in. I didn't belong. I wasn't a part. I just, it's just the way I felt, you know, and I never thought it was going to work for me in this stuff. I didn't think anyone was going to work for me. So as a kid, I didn't fit in. I didn't do that kind of stuff. But what happened was is I ended up building this treehouse in my parents' front yard when I was about 14 years old. And all I wanted was my own room. That's all I really wanted at the time. I had brothers and sisters, but I wanted my own room. And what happened was is that when I had finished building my treehouse, it was actually pretty nice. I had a room that was 8 feet wide. It was 15 feet long. I made it so you could stand up in it. I sloped the roof so that it wouldn't leak in the rain. I put tar paper on it. I ran an extension cord up there. And I had my stereo up there, and I had like my own little place in the sky. Now stop and think about what I just described to you for just a moment. A room 8 feet wide and 15 feet long. What did I just describe to you? A cell. I love that line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says we live in a self-imposed crisis. By the way, I bring this for as a visual aid. This is my Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if you can see this. It's falling apart. I actually using pieces of duct tape on this. We were talking about it. Said they should have had Gorilla Tape when I was younger, you know, that kind of a thing. But this is what a working Big Book looks like. And you might have heard it said, you know what, if you find somebody with a Big Book that's falling apart, you know that their program isn't. The truth is that when I take people through the steps, I still use this book, but I can't use this by itself. Because I'm missing pages, parts of the edges are gone, and I try to use it as best I can. I love that line in the book where it actually says, if you have a newcomer, loan him your copy of your book. I'm like, oh no, you're not getting this one. This has all the secrets of sobriety written in the margins, you know, years of recovery and digging, going, like, I'll buy you a new book, but you're not getting mine, you know, that's the kind of thing. But the truth is, you don't have to. You can just, there's tons of books at every meeting you go to. But anyway, it's like, you know what? What happened was I ended up building this treehouse in my parents' front yard. And what happened was when I was about, like I said, about 14, going on 15, a guy from up the street came down and said, hey, David, do you want a party? And what I heard was, you want to hang out with the coolest guy you know? And I don't know about anybody else, but all I ever wanted to be was cool. And I was anything but cool. You know, like I said, I was the guy that wasn't fitting in. I'm my friend Nancy calls the D-stop student, you know? I don't fit in. I don't belong. You know, it's just everybody's better than me. You all have better clothes. Yada, 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 yada. All that kind of stuff that runs through our head. But the thing is like, here I am. And I end up building this treehouse in my parents' front yard. And I'm not cool. I'm not cool at all. And here's this guy from up the street. And Mark, that guy's name is Mark. And Mark had hair down the middle of his back. Mark drank and did drugs and partied and had girlfriends and money. And he says, hey, David, do you want to party? And what I heard was, do you want to hang out with the coolest guy you know? And he could have said, hey, do you want to go kill somebody? And I probably would have said yes. You know, it doesn't matter. It's like, cool. And I was anything but cool. And he came up there that day, and I caught a buzz. And it wasn't just a little bitty buzz. It was a great big buzz around from the top of my head down the ends of my toes. And I started to laugh, and I laughed. I laughed so hard, I threw up. I laughed so hard. I don't know if you've ever laughed that hard. And it did something for me. And I found this out that, you know, have you ever heard the statistics they throw around in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time? And some of them they make up. I'm telling you that right now. They say that 90% of the people that do H&I work stay sober. Where did they get that number? I don't know, but it's just like, you know, it's just one of the numbers they used to say. But the truth of the matter is that they do say this, that they say 10% of the population are alcoholic in the world, roughly. 10% of the people, so 90% of the population is not alcoholic. If you take the number of people there are in the world today, there is roughly 8 billion people in the world, roughly. There's a little bit less than that, but roughly there's 8 billion people in the world. So technically, if you look at it just from a numbers standpoint, straight up numbers, I'm not making any of these numbers up. There are 800 million alcoholics, almost a billion alcoholics in the world. 800 million people are alcoholic. And if you call AA World Services today, right now, after the meeting, on your break, well, they won't answer, but if you call tomorrow and ask them, how many sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous are there? They're going to tell you about 2.5 million people. 2.5 million sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're here tonight and you got one day of sobriety or more, you already won the AA lottery, because that is less than 1/3 of 1% of the potential alcoholics in the world ever get and stay sober any length of time. So I love that kind of odds. You know, that's like if you're here, you already got it, man. You already got it. But that guy came up there, and I absolutely love the effect. I love the effects of alcohol and drug. I don't say that in a past tense phrase. I still love them. And if I could drink and get loaded and get away with it, you'd have a different speaker here tonight, but I can't, because when I drink and I get loaded, I pay a really, really, really big price. I don't know if you've ever heard Tom W. speak from up in the Bay Area, and he says it this way. He says, alcoholism goes into 3 basic stages. The first stage is fun with no problems. The second stage is problems with fun. And then the final and end stages of games is problems with no fun. Bill Wilson puts it this way, and back again to the best kept secret in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, first I was drinking for fun and conviviality. Then he says, I was drinking out of need and necessity. And then the third reason, he says, for the worst reason of all, oblivion. And I don't know about you, but I think it's really kind of the same thing. It's just a different way of looking at the same coin. You know, it's just a different, I think it's exactly the same thing. And in the beginning, that's exactly the way it was for me. I absolutely loved it. I was reading this story a few years ago in this particular book, and there was a story about a monk named Dom Perignon. He basically invented champagne. And what happened was, is Dom is like, he's upstairs on the second floor of this monastery in France, and he's like cooking it and drinking and cooking and drinking and cooking and drinking. I don't know if that sounds familiar to anybody besides me, but you know, that's what he was doing. And what happened was, is he ends up like getting too drunk from just sampling it so much while he was working on it. And he ends up falling down the stairs of the monastery. And as he's laying at the bottom of the stairs, there's just a whack, and he's laying down there, all the other monks come running up, surround him, and they're looking down him, and they're like, Dom, what happened? And he looks up at them and he said, I have been drinking stars. I don't know about you, but when I read that, it ran chills down my spine, because it's exactly what it's like when I drink and I get loaded. It's like that old Zen Buddhist joke. I don't know if you've ever heard it. He goes to a hot dog vendor and says, make me one with everything. That's what it was like when I drank and got loaded. Like, made me one with everything. I don't know if you know the second part of that joke. It actually goes like this, where the hot dog vendor, I mean, the Buddhist monk then says to the hot dog vendor, can I have my change? And the hot dog vendor goes, ah, but change must come from within. That's the second half of that joke. You know? That's the deal. And it does something for me. It does something for me, and it only does it in, as I said, 1 in 10. 1 in 10 people just get this kind of reaction. And basically, it didn't matter what it was. If you told me it would get me drunk, if you told me it would get me loaded, if you told me it would catch me a buzz, I would take it, drink it, huff it, puff it, shoot it. I didn't particularly care. I'm like a garbage disposal, you know? And I always like to use this example. Is there anybody in this room besides me that's smoked banana peels? There usually is a couple of people, none. You know, there's a song out there. It's called Mellow Yellow. And it's about smoking banana peels. You know, I'm thinking, if there's a song, it should work. You know, I felt cheated by that, you know? I'm the kind of person that I go into your bathroom and I'm on a mission. Are there any mission people in here besides me tonight? There's always a couple of mission people. And if you're on a mission in somebody else's bathroom, you know what I'm talking about. You go in and you flip open the medicine cabinet. Now, I'm not looking for anything specific. What I'm looking for are those red and orange warning labels on the sides of the bottles. I don't even care what they are. And they say things like, do not operate heavy machinery. Oh, that's a keeper, I'm taking some of those. The other one, is do not mix with alcohol. That's a pretty good bet. It's going to do you what you want. My all-time favorite was may cause drowsiness. Hell, I'm counting on it, you know? I mean, that's just the way it was. I'm also the kind of person that when I walk into your house, your vanilla extract is in danger. And only a real alcoholic's going to catch that. Because have you ever seen the real vanilla? It's like 40 proof. You know, if you're having a bad day and you can't find anything, you know, you can chug on that and it'll take the edge off. You smell like cookies for a couple of days. But hey, you know, that's the kind of things we do. And that's just the way I am. But the thing is, it's like 14, 15, 16 years old, I'm just drinking, getting loaded all the time, because when you're that age, you need a place to party, and people used to come by my treehouse, and I only got one rule. You got to share it with me. I love that rule. It meant I got drunk and loaded a lot for free. I would just get back up there and party all the time. However, I didn't have like a shutoff valve ever. Never, ever, ever. From the very beginning, I hit this thing running. I was waiting for some chemical reaction to change the way I looked and how I felt about myself and the way I viewed the world. I was waiting for it. And as soon as I got it, man, I mean, I absolutely loved it. And I basically dropped out of school and started partying all the time. But the problem is if you drink and get loaded the way I do, well-intentioned, good-meaning people in our lives start like giving us these really bizarre questions. And if you've ever been in that situation, these well-intentioned, good-meaning people say things like this, like, what are you going to do with your life? I don't know if you've ever had that question. God, I hated that question with a passion. I didn't know. I felt like cornered by that. I didn't know how to answer it. And I couldn't get away from it when they would run it at me, you know? And what happened was, when I was about 16 years old, I read the life story of Jim Morrison. If you don't know who Jim Morrison is, he was the lead singer of a group called The Doors. He was the bad boy poet artist of the 60s. And Jim Morrison basically drank and abused himself to death. He abused himself to death with alcohol and drugs. And I remember it, and he died at the age of 27 years old from the use and abuse of alcohol and drugs. I remember the book was called No One Here Gets Out Alive, written by a guy named Danny Sugarman, and I always forget the other one that helped him write it. And they were part of the troop that ran around with them. And what happened was, I remember reading that, and I'm 16 years old, and I went, oh, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to be a rock star because I can't sing, I can't play any musical instrument, and I don't want to come down out of my tree. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to drink and use myself to death. Live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse, the James Dean theory of life, you know? I'm going to live my life like a rock and roll lyric. It's better to burn out than fade away. Now, that's what I would tell myself. Now, all of a sudden, I got a pan answer, because that's the truth to that question. I feel so cornered by, what are you going to do with your life, you know? Now, I'm getting that second stage, which is fun with problems. And I always like to say that if you need to have a drunk driving to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way, not that we're going to be taking a poll, but how many people here have gotten drunk driving? How many people? There's always quite a few. Wow, man, that's heavy duty. I blew a 2.4. I don't know what you did, but that was mine. I think a topic for a meeting should be, what was your blood alcohol level when you got arrested? I think that would be a great topic for a meeting. I got my drunk driving on a moped. If you don't know what a moped is, basically it's a motorized bicycle. And see if anybody identifies with this particular emotion. I'm at a party and I'm afraid I'm not gonna get my fair share. Any other my fair share people in here tonight? You know what I'm talking about. See, when I get drunk or I get loaded, I need to get there. I don't know specifically where there actually is, but I know that if I'm at a party and you're drinking or whatever you're doing, you're taking some of my share to get there. I don't know why I think that, you know, that's just the way I felt. But I had a big P Army coat on. I had this moped that was dying of alcoholism. There's only two rules to a vehicle dying of alcoholism. Can you get it started and can you keep it running? Everything else is negotiable. And this moped had no headlight. It had a spark plug wire, but the spark plug wire was actually a coat hanger going from the distributor to the spark plug, which is fine as long as you don't brush your leg up against that thing when it's running. You know, if you've ever been kicked by a spark plug, you know what I'm talking about. And I was at this party and I had this big P Army coat on. And every time I would go by this big ice chest full of beer, I would reach over and I would grab a bottle and I thought nobody was looking. Do you ever think nobody was looking, you know, in those kind of situations? And I would grab it and I'd stick it in one of my pockets. So it's like a beer for me and a beer for my jacket, a beer for me and a beer for my jacket. It would get to the point where I couldn't get any more beer in this coat. And I turned to walk away and you could hear the bottles clanking and stuff like that. And I think I'm being slick. I think I'm being cool. I think I'm getting away with something. But hindsight is 20/20. And in my mind's eye, I can see them saying, at least he's leaving. And I got on that moped and I went driving down the middle of Foothill Boulevard on a Friday night, like at 10 o'clock at night. And you know what happened, don't you? Woo! And the first thought in my head is, gee, I wonder why they're pulling me over. You know, I got no headline. I'm staggering down the road on this vehicle. And they impounded my moped. I thought that was rude. It's barely even a vehicle. You know, they impounded it. And I got a drunk driving like that, you know, and that's the way I got mine. I'm also an unsuccessful suicide. Any other unsuccessful suicides in the house? Yep. I'm unsuccessful suicide. I was at a party one night and I wanted the party to keep going. And I knew a friend of mine had some stuff in her house and I could break in and get it. And she caught me breaking into her house. And I don't know if you've ever been so drunk that you had that self-loathing and deprecation because you got caught doing something you shouldn't have. You know, I love that part in the book where it talks about that. We're appalled that somebody might have seen our behavior. And what happened was she said, David, just go home. And I decided I was going to jump off the freeway bridge, which is like, you know, it's like 35 feet off the freeway. You know, I climbed up there. And I'll tell you this right now. It seemed like a really, really good idea when I was climbing up there. It didn't seem like nearly as good an idea when I got up there. But I'm up there. And what happened was, I remember there's a battle going on. On one side of your shoulder, it's the alcoholic ego. It says, you climbed up here. You need to jump. And the other side is your sense of self-preservation. It says, if you jump, you're going to die. And the battle goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And all of us, any time we've any length of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, know people that have listened to the wrong guy or the wrong gal on our shoulders. We've all lost people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Case in point, my friend Junior, on time to go into the story, but I lost him at 7 years of sobriety. And he had seven, and he was in and out, and then committed suicide. And here I am, I'm up there and I'm trying to screw up the courage to jump, and I don't know what to do because I got the battle going on, and a car pulls up from down below and a guy gets out and goes, don't jump. And I think to myself, thank God I got somebody else to talk me down. And I went, I won't. I climbed down off that bridge, I got into his car and we went to a party. I don't know if that sounds bizarre to anybody besides me, but that's the kind of stuff we do, you know? And I'm obnoxious, I'm rude, I get in fights with people twice my size. There's a period of time where I was drinking vodka of the gods and Trader Joe's vodka of the gods. $4.99 for a half a gallon, you could strip paint off of chairs, but it got the job done. You know, it tastes like turpentine, but who cares at $4.99 because I'm going the bang for my buck. You know, and I would drink, mix that with Rainier's Ale, so it's vodka of the gods and Rainier's Ale, and all these kind of different things. And what happens is I'm obnoxious, I'm rude, I just do all this kind of stuff, but for me, I just can't seem to get away from it. You know, I can't stop, and by this time, I had kind of from time to time tried to stop, but I could never do it. You know, and now I'm getting to the point where I need to stop. But for me, the monster must be fed. And I absolutely love the definition, back to the Best Kept Secret in Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book of AA. In the doctor's opinion, it says that we have an allergy to the body, an obsession of the mind. The allergy of the body condemns me to drink against my will, and the obsession tells me I don't have the allergy of the body, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Intellectually, that makes perfectly good sense. You understand English, you go, yeah, that makes sense. But the thing is, it's got to mean more to people like us than that. It's got to have, as the book says, it's got to have depth and weight. It's got to be personal to me. It's got to be personal. And if we don't personify these things, if you look at the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as we heard them read tonight, the thing is they're very generic in their nature, and they did that on purpose. They did that so that we could custom make them and fit them to our lives. I think one of the most overlooked, understated line in the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe it's in chapter 3, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it says this. It says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This doesn't mean I convinced you that I'm an alcoholic. It means I got to convince myself. So I got to personify these steps. If you look at the foreword to the second edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says it this way. It says, a wholesale miracle is happening among us. Wholesale. I think the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe a dictionary is just as much a spiritual tool as a lot of things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked up the word wholesale in the dictionary, and one of the definitions that it uses is it's for anybody. And that's what their point was when they wrote that in the book, because it had exploded by that time onto the scene. And there was a real hope, as opposed to taking somebody out by the edge of town and stoning them to death instead. You know, that kind of a thing. We can do this kind of stuff and have it work in our lives. And what it was is I got to personify the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't personify them. It's just information. And I was watching this movie. If you've never seen this movie, I highly recommend it. It's called Little Shop of Horrors. Rick Moranis is in it. Steve Martin is a demented dentist. And there's a plant from outer space that lives on human blood. And what happens is at the time, the plant's getting weaker and smaller down on Skid Row. And on this is where the flower shop is located. I think that's very apropos. I personally do. And what happens is the plant's getting weaker and smaller, and Rick Moranis accidentally cuts his finger, and the plant starts getting bigger and stronger as it gets the blood. It goes, feed me, Seymour. And to me, that's the disease of alcoholism. Seymour goes, feed me, David. And the monster must be fed. And the monster is insatiable. The monster cannot be stopped. Now, so what I did is I decided I was going to quit drinking, but because the monster must be fed, is I switched to methamphetamines, and I love methamphetamines. Are there any other tweakers besides me tonight? You're using the back rock. Quite a bunch of you guys up here, you know. And the thing is that I'm just that's what it is. I love it. I used to tell people, I haven't had a drink in 6 months. I've only been asleep twice, but hey, sobriety through methamphetamines, you know. And I used to tell people that, you know, but I got bizarre in that stuff, and I'll tell you this right now, if you're tweaking really, really bad, being 20 feet in a tree is a bad place to be. I'll just tell you that right now, it's just tough. And I got all paranoid, I got down to 110 pounds, I thought I looked good at 110 pounds, you know, I weigh 175 now. And what happened was, I would sit there, and I got really paranoid, really bad, and I thought they were coming to get me. I thought Care Bears were coming down from outer space to overthrow the world. I thought my parents were cyborgs, you know. I thought, just on and on and on. I thought the radio was following me. My wife's favorite story is the Federal Squirrels. Excuse me. And the Federal Squirrels is this. I perceived that the squirrels, I'm in a tree, so I have squirrels running across the roof of my treehouse and stuff like that. And I perceived that was not their natural behavior. Like, I know different for some reason, you know. And what happened was, is I could see, since it's not their natural behavior, what it is it's this. That the federal government had trained squirrels and said, go get David on Tuesdays at 3 o'clock. You know? That's just one of the stories. And I can tell you, I lived in a paranoid psychosis like this for the last 2.5 years I was out there, man. It was horrible. And I finally convinced myself that nobody was coming to get me. And I always like to say that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not coming to get you. And what happened was, I forgot to mention, this whole time I was selling drugs to the local high school kids out of my treehouse. And they didn't like that, and they raided my treehouse. Now, When they raided my treehouse, they didn't quite know how to raid a treehouse. They had to bring down fire trucks, cops in riot gear, hook and ladder, 20 cops out in my parents' front yard. And what happened was my dad came out and he yelled up to me, he said, David, they're coming up. And they did. They kicked in the drawer of my treehouse. They said they didn't like drug dealing tree dwellers in Locker Center. They took me into custody. And what they did is they stuck me in a holding tank with my father. Because when my father yelled up to me, they arrested my father for obstruction of justice. Now, this is my bottom. I don't know what your bottom is, but this is my bottom. I'm sitting in a holding tank with my dad, and he's there because of me. And I remember just looking at my feet, and it's just my opinion. They wanted to see if he would kill me. That's just my opinion on that one. And I'm looking at my feet. I remember looking up, and I pull my head up finally after like 10 minutes, and I look my dad in the eye, and I say those two words that alcoholics of my type are so famous for. You know what those two words are, don't you? I'm sorry. We're the sorriest people in the world. And basically what happened was, is all of a sudden, I think one of the big lies that we used to tell ourselves is this one. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. It's one of the big lies we used to tell ourselves when we're out there. Well, now, I'll tell you what I love about denial, what I adore about denial, is when I'm in denial, even if I'm intellectually agreeing with you, something deep down in my heart is going, but it doesn't really apply to me. Once we crack that ball of denial, we can no longer believe the lie. That's what it's really all about. And it's not enough if you're an alcoholic like me. I kind of mentioned it earlier. Ill health, the warning of a doctor, falling in love, all these different things, the frothy emotional appeal they talk about in the doctor's opinion. None of that stuff will work for people like us. And I was out there for another 2 years, and I kind of mentioned that last year I was out there. And that's that last couple of years and all that kind of the psychosis and all that kind of stuff and all the trouble I was getting in and trying to stay out of jail and all this kind of stuff. I was looking at 3 years joint suspended. I finally ended up going to a place called American Hospital because I was just trying to stay out of jail, and I was there for 28 day spin dry, and I got loaded again as soon as I got out of there. And then I went through Impact House in Pasadena, and I was there for 89 days, and they threw me out, and I was drunk and loaded within 12 hours, you know. And then all of a sudden, when I came through the doors on December 19th of 1988, I don't know what made that day any other different than any other day, other than this is one of my personal opinions, is that we don't pick our sobriety dates pick us. And what happened was, is on that day, I had people sit there and say, how do you get sober 6 days before Christmas? And the fact that Christmas was coming was just one little piece in the puzzle of what was going on in my life, because it was such a mess. I had a ninth grade education. I had been arrested a couple of dozen times. I was bat nuts crazy. I was dying of this disease. I was looking at prison, all this kind of different stuff, and I didn't know what else to do. And I thought to myself, if people would just get off my back, I'll be okay. Oh my God, the insanity, the self-deception. I love that line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it talks about the denial, you know, the real denial of it. I can't remember right now. I always love that. It's like we have a speaker that says, if you get lost in anything, just go, and then it got worse. Like it doesn't get worse for us, you know? And the thing is there it was, you know? And when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on December 19th of 1988, I was just willing to do anything. I was hopeless. As Bill said, when Ebby carried the message to him, he says, was I interested in what Ebby had to offer me? He said, of course I was, for I was hopeless. And I was hopeless when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, not because of any other reason other than the fact that I didn't know what to do. I had burned my life to the ground. I barely got through this thing. I was looking at 3 years in prison. I was dying of disease. And you know, I kind of mentioned I planned on dying when I was 25 years old. Actually, I don't know if I actually said that, but that was my plan. My plan was to die when I was 25 years old, and I was 3 months before my 25th birthday, and I was getting that close. And what happened was, is I came in here, and there was an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous by the name of Norm Alpe, and he used to say that we buy the package, and I bought the package of Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I thought it would work, because I didn't know what else to do. You know, and the thing is that for me, I kind of talked about this a little bit, and I'm going to kind of touch on this, is that there's a line in the doctor's opinion, and my sponsor shared this a while back, and I love this so much. It says, once having formed the habit and found we cannot break it, once having lost our self-confidence, our reliance upon things human. And he's talking about that cycle of spree and remorse that Scott Redmond used to talk about so much. And we're out there. In the beginning, we do it, and it's just like we kind of brush it off and brush it off and brush it off. But after 10, 50, 20 years of doing that cycle of spree and remorse, the look that we have of ourselves, ourselves, you know, you talked about the self-love when you were up here talking about that. We come in here and we hate the fact that we are so weak and spineless. As it says in the Big Book, we're not weak and spineless. Set to our minds, we can do so many things, but when it comes to alcohol, we're strangely insane. And I love that. And the thing was, is like, I came in here and I didn't think I could stay sober. I had tried it a few times. I'd sworn off with and without alcohol. What is I started doing the stuff that you guys sat around here. Not because I thought it worked, because I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know what else to do. And I love this. I heard this recently and I absolutely love this. You know what? When we are doing the 12-step program, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous. How many people come into a 12-step program of any kind and don't do the 12 steps? And the thing is, it's like the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are not an option for recovery. And in a lot of ways, a lot of the traditions that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous that aren't strictly outlined in the steps are also not options. There are things that we do to uphold and maintain our sobriety. As you said, it's on rent, you know? One of the great lines in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Falls into exactly what you said. If you look up the word reprieve in the dictionary, it means a temporary suspension on a sentence of death. And the thing is we come in here as a result of doing the stuff that we've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, by doing the steps of AA, by getting a sponsor, by being a service, you know, by taking these commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, one of the first commitments I had in Alcoholics Anonymous was being a coffee maker in our Sunday night meeting. At the beginning, I didn't think I could do it. We had those big coffee urns, not these ones you just push a button now. Back in those days, you had to start up the coffee pot 3 days before the meeting started. You know? You had to get there early and start it up. And in the beginning, I didn't know how to do it. Inside of a month, I had some pride in that coffee commitment, you know? I didn't have a job, so I couldn't put money in the basket. But I could make the bet. I'm going to be the next circuit coffee maker in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? We started getting commitments in AA. I started praying to God, not because I thought it worked, because it was one of the things that you guys suggested that I heard from the people that were sharing the meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, that oral history, the oral connection that we get with people sharing meetings, because one of the best defenses that I had to keep you out was just saying, you know what, I can't let you in. But when I would be sharing, people would be sharing in meetings, all of a sudden, the wall would kind of open up a little bit and I would start to laugh a little bit. And it says somewhere in the back of the book that there's three things that are indispensable to recovery. That's honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. Open-mindedness. I didn't know how to be open-minded, but you guys, with your stories and your humor and the gallows humor that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is second to none. It really is. It's incredible. We laugh at people, at some of the stuff that they do and things like that. And it is incredible because we identify. We identify with the insanity. You remember when I first started talking, I said that we are connected in our brokenness. You know, that's what it's really all about around here. And I came in here and I started doing the stuff that you said, not because I worked, because I didn't know what else to do. And I absolutely love this kind of stuff. And I ended up getting married in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I think you guys did too. And other people have. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, but I recommend it. But one of the things that I recommend, if you're gonna date anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, that this is the only thing, this is the only caveat that I have. That the person you're dating has done a fifth step, a four step, and a fifth step with their sponsor. Other than that, it's like a boy meets girl across AA campus with 30 days each. It's like two ticks and no dog. It's a lot of fun to watch, but my God. You watch them and then they break up and you wonder who gets custody of the meeting. I don't know if you've ever lost custody of the meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and that kind of stuff. And the thing is, if you're sponsoring a guy that's doing that kind of stuff, it's actually kind of fun because now all of a sudden, it says somewhere in the 12 and 12 that pain is the touchstone to all spiritual growth. Hey, let's get on that inventory. Let's look at our behavior, that kind of stuff. We can do these kind of things. And we learn that by doing this stuff around here, all of a sudden, where we were at that point that I talked about 10 minutes ago, where it says, once having formed the habit of family, we cannot break it. Once having lost our self-confidence, our reliance upon things human, we find out that we don't rely upon ourselves because, as Chuck Chamberlain used to say, if I'm trying to fix this with my mind, I'm in a trap I cannot spring. I got to do what you guys suggested me in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is why I think that when we have commitments and meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I should treat commitments not only like is it an honor or privilege, I should treat it like I'm getting paid. I should treat the commitments of Alcoholics Anonymous, from the person picking up the cigarette butts to the secretary to whatever you're doing, like I'm bucking for a raise. That's how I should treat these commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what I try to do. I have people say to me, David, how do you keep your enthusiasm in Alcoholics Anonymous? I came in here with nothing. I came in here batnuts crazy, dying of disease, completely insane, you know, thinking that alien invasions were going on. I was suffering from auditory and visual hallucinations. I got problems in areas of my life today where I didn't have areas when I got here. I don't know if you've ever heard that before, but that's exactly what happens to me around here. And it's been an amazing journey. And I wish I had the time to take you through the steps. I wish I had time to talk about the ups and downs and things that happened to me when I was out there. I'm not out there, but in sobriety. But that's between you and your sponsor. Now, for the last 45 minutes or so, you've all been a part of my sobriety. And hopefully, I've been a part of yours. A couple people got up and went out. I don't know if they got drunk in the bathroom, because that actually happens in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes. I don't think so, but you never know. But the thing is that this is what happens around here. As a result of doing this, we are able to get and stay sober when people like us could not get and stay sober before. That is the great news Alcoholics Anonymous carries to those who suffer from this disease. And I love what happens around here. I can't wait to see what happens next. I've been at talking about the International Convention. I'm trying to go into that. I'm going to that next year. I've been to three of them so far, so I'm looking forward to that. I told you I'm married. I got my son. My son just turned 2 kids, one's 18, one's 20. I don't have time to tell the story of my 18-year-old son. But I'll tell you this right now. This has been an amazing year for me, and it's incredible what's going on in my life today. And I could have missed it all. I could have missed it all. If I hadn't come in here and done this stuff, the enthusiasm that I have, you know what? It's just incredible what happens to people like us in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if there's nothing else, if I just give just a little bitty, teeny little bit of hope to somebody that's new, or even somebody that's been around for a while struggling with this thing, a little bit of hope that this thing could work, a little bit of hope when you're hopeless is oceans. And that's the incredible thing that happens when we start doing this kind of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And I love what happens around here. I'm going to wrap this up now because I ran out of time, and I wish I had time to tell you more stuff, because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you this right now. I have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the old Circus Jack. Have you ever seen it? I got it tattooed on my back. As far as I know, I'm the only patched member of Alcoholics Anonymous out there. And the thing is, like, it's just, I love what happens around here. And when Lee says, hey, can you come up here and drive, you know, 12 hours up to our meeting and share with you guys tonight? I'm happy to do it. It's not true. It's like a little bit less than that, but that's the thing. What a privilege and an honor to be able to carry this message. Now, I told you when I was pretty much started that I was shooting for three things. One of them was that maybe I might say something and you might say to yourself, I've done that. Hopefully I shared some stories like that and you kind of identified with some of the things that I did. Maybe I said something about how I felt and you thought to yourself, I felt that way. But the biggest one, what I'm really hoping that somewhere during the night, because of the stories I told and the things I talked and my passion for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new here, you might say to yourself, maybe this thing can work for me too. And I wrap up my pitch the same way every time. There's a poem. It's called The Touch of the Master's Hand. It reminds me exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous is for. And it just strikes a nerve, and it goes like this. It was battered and scarred in the auctioneer, thought it was scarcely worth his while to waste his time with the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bid, good people, he cried, who starts the bidding for me? $1, $1, do I hear two? $2, who makes it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three, but no. From the room far back, a gray-bearded man came forward and picked up the bow. Then wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up the strings, he played a melody, pure and sweet as the angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, what now am I bid for this old violin, as he held it aloft with its bow? $1,000, $1,000, do I hear two? $2,000, who makes it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, going and gone, said he. The audience cheered, but some of them crying. We don't understand what change it's worth. Swift came the reply, the touch of the master's hand. And many a man, whose life out of tune, all battered with bourbon and sin, is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game he travels on. He is going once, he is going twice, he is going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul, the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand. And I have that battered and scarred violin. Hopefully the master has played me well. Thank you guys for having me. Yeah.
Let's give him another round of applause.